Blog Talk Radio.
The Abolitionist Hour. I'm your host, Carl G. Call in at 646-716-8652. And don't forget to push 1. Broadcasting from the southern plains of the greater Midwest in Kansas City, overlooking the beautiful Kaw River Valley in lovely Wyandotte County, Kansas, and occupied Osage Indian Territory. So greetings, ex-prisoners, partisans, communards, brigadiers, and lumpen proletariat. This is the Prison Abolitionist Hour podcast, celebrating 370 years of anti-capitalist thought through reasoning and rebellion.
It's the Abolitionist Hour. Welcome back. It's Saturday, March 26th, 2022. And the great minds in Washington turn the clocks forward. So now we have daylight. And so this is the daylight edition of the Abolitionist Hour. And it's the cracks that let the light in. Is that right, Mike? I got my host,
yeah,
Mike.
Right. Yes, it's daylight here.
Yeah. My blueberry bushes are blooming.
Oh, nothing like that here.
Yeah,
the ground's still froze. The ground is still froze out here.
Wow.
You get 2 inches down, it's ice. An edge.
Yeah. I thought I was doing good on my raised beds until the last three snowstorms, and it really packed it down. So I got more work to do on the raised beds. I won't be growing out of the raised beds this year.
I haven't even went out to look. I'm just like, I know it's going to be just nonstop work for the. They used to call springtime in the Middle Ages. They called springtime the starvation time because spring meant all the food was gone after the winter, and you got to starve your ass off till you got out there and got everything going. So
yeah.
I think our guest called in.
Oh really? Let's go to Michelle. Let's just go right in and let's see if we can get Michelle talking for 2 hours.
I don't ask.
Well, let's
you
keep it going. If she starts,
I'm putting her on the air. Michelle, you're on the air, and I don't expect preachers to do that. Okay. Matter of fact, it gets pretty boring when preachers do it. Michelle, you're on the air.
Can you hear me okay?
Hi.
Yeah, we can.
This is Michelle Smith, and tell us about this amazing news that we saw on Channel 5 this week.
So, thank you first for, having me on this evening. I definitely appreciate the opportunity to talk to the community. So I have a bill, a legislative bill in Missouri. It is the number for it. It's House Bill 2523. And what this particular bill does is address one aspect of wrongful convictions in our state, and that is informant usage. If you look at the statistics, people who are wrongfully convicted, 60% of the time they were wrongfully convicted because of informants, which you know, as we call them, some people call them snitches or CIs or any of those particular terms. But these people are used in, you know, serious court cases basically to get convictions. And because the court is always more prejudicial towards the prosecutors or the state side, you know, a lot of the stories and the testimony that are provided are not true or and cannot be corroborated. It's just the fact that, you know, the person came and said what they said, and that's going to help the prosecution convict someone. So this bill will address that, and it's not to have the court system not use informants, and that's what some people confuse. It is to make sure that the usage of informant testimony is, you know, transparent. It is also to make sure that the story that the person is saying aligns with the actual evidence in the case. And a lot of times those things are not true. And also the many informants, and especially the people who are in jail, which are called jailhouse informants, as you know, Carl, they get deals off of their own cases. And so, you know, a lot of times those people have victims and they have cases, and if they're getting a deal, their victim don't know why they're getting time off of, you know, their case because they victimized someone else. And so this bill will also address that to make sure if we're going to, you know, do victims' rights, make sure that victims understand that they're, you know, the person who committed a crime against them are getting leniency because they're telling on someone else. So this bill has several components, again, to just make the entire process more transparent and more accountable to stop having so many wrongfully convicted people, because it is a serious problem. You know, that last fall, Mr. Strickland came home. The year before that, a young man named Jonathan Irons was exonerated here. The year or two before that, you know, Ricky Kidd also was exonerated. And a couple years before that, Daryl Burden and other people. So over the years, there have been people exonerated in Missouri, but the larger community doesn't understand that it's more than just one or two people every other year. This is a systemic issue. There are many people incarcerated right now in Missouri and nationwide that are wrongfully convicted. A friend of mine said, we sat down one night and we counted 30 people that we both knew, and that's the only people we know. And so this issue is systemic. It is built into the system because, you know, the court system is not always fair. They don't, you know, let the jury know all of the different aspects of what's going on. It's a lot of secrecy involved with the people on the jury. They don't know that informant has, you know, informed on 10 other cases. They just assume this one person knew this one thing, but that's not it. It's often something they repeatedly do. So we just really want to make sure that, of course, are using these particular people, it is above board so that we stop getting all of these wrongful convictions because, you know, we just passed the 3,000 mark nationwide of people exonerated in this country, and over 60% of those people, they were originally convicted because of informants. So that's a lot. You know, that is the number one cause of wrongful convictions, honestly, is informant testimony, perjured testimony from informants. So, you know, that's the reason for the bill, to address the systemic issue and not just the individual case.
Wow. So, so this, because, I mean, there's a lot of problems with prosecution, witnesses, and a lot, some people might not know that people are, witnesses can be brought out of prison and testify in court. Is that right? Or how do they do that? Is that just like a secret witness? They give them protection, or will they actually bring anybody into court?
Well, it's definitely not secret, at least for the court, for the prosecution and the police is not secret. If you actually look in the federal rules of court procedure, there is a federal rule, I believe it's 35B, that gives time to people off of their sentence for informing on somebody else. So there's a federal rule in court that says if you inform on someone, you get a certain amount of time off your sentence. And that's why a lot of people, it's like almost their job. It's like a career. It's what they do for either money or living. There have been informants that have been reported on that have made $100,000 from different police departments over the whole country informing on people. So either there's monetary benefit, you know, there's time off of their own case. And like I said, in the federal system, there is an actual court law. It's like a rule, a federal rule, court rule that says that you can give people so much time off. So these things are well known, you know, within the system. It's not well known out here. You know, we do think that, of course, people know there are snitches. You know, most people understand that concept, but they don't understand the systemic nature of using these particular people to get convictions. They don't understand that they're shopped around. You know, it's often a situation where the prosecutor or the police, they have something that they want to prove, and they figure out a way to bring someone in to, you know, add that particular area of proof. That so it's they have the story before they got the person, basically is what I'm trying to say. So it is definitely something that, you know, they know. But again, once you get to court, the jury doesn't know that. You know, the jury sees an informant come in, they assume, oh, this is a friend of the person that's just trying to, you know, do a good deed and, you know, tell on the crime that they did or something on that line, and they don't understand that person was planted, that person was, you know, promised things from the police or the prosecutor to come in and tell the story. So the jury doesn't have all of that information. And that is really a problem because they need to. The person who, and I'm not even saying the person made $100,000. That's not hyperbole. There is an expose, a story, and I can see the link, where they tracked this particular informant, and over years he had made over $100,000 as an informant across the country. They would literally fly this person to different states. It was like a gang member type of thing. So they would literally fly him around. He would infiltrate different gangs or people that they assumed were in gangs, and he would inform on them. Literally made $100,000. This was his job. That's not okay.
No, now, and I don't know if people know about this, but There's like gang task force money. So if a county out in the middle of Iowa can claim there's gang activity, they get federal funding by proving that. So it would be advantageous to bring in a professional witness. Is that right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That's definitely what's going on. And of course, they want to confiscate, you know, any type of they want to do the asset forfeiture, the confiscate their money and possessions, so that they turn around and use that money for the same purposes. And also, I'll talk about one particular case. Currently, there is a man, he's from St. Louis, actually. His name is Christopher Dunn. And Chris has been in prison over 30 years now, wrongfully convicted. And in his case, this happened in the early 90s. And in his case, it wasn't necessarily informants, but they were children. They were like teenagers like he was, maybe 13, 14, 15 years old. I can't remember exactly the ages, but they were kids who were basically coerced by the police. You know, police are telling them, come and say this, and we're going to do this for you, or we're going to put you in jail. And a lot of times, that's the situation as well, is coercion. And, of course, these were, you know, teenagers. They went along with the story, and Chris has been in prison for a decade, and he is still today fighting to get exonerated. So it's easy to convict someone. It's easy to bring someone to court, say, yeah, that person did this, but if that person can prove later on that they did not do it and they're innocent, it's very, very difficult to get from under a wrongful conviction. So Chris is one person, of course, in Kansas City. We're currently, you know, focused on Mr. Keith Carnes. Hopefully Keith will be home soon. But in Keith's case as well, there was an informant. So it's always someone with an ulterior motive coming forward to give a story or either getting coerced by the police. And, you know, these things are just accepted in court. Now, we know that if a defense witness comes in and says, I'm the alibi for this person, the prosecutor is going to question them, going to drag them through the mud, going to, you know, look back at their entire life and see what they did when they were 12. You know, they're going to, you know what I'm saying, do all of that to prove that a defense witness is not being truthful. But when it's a prosecution witness, they go out of their way to cover for that person, to, you know, make it seem like they're above board, make it seem like they're just trying to be helpful. It is such a dynamic, a different dynamic within how the prosecution side is treated in court versus the defense. So it's very sad. And those dynamics that you know, their power difference, it leads to people being wrongfully convicted in Missouri and nationwide.
Michelle, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Could you
mm-hmm.
clarify, is this bill, does it have a bill number in Jefferson City, Missouri? Is it in a committee, and what committee? Who is the sponsoring legislature, maybe, that is bringing this bill? Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'll definitely can tell you all that. So it does have a bill number. It's House Bill 2523, and the person sponsoring it was Representative Nick Schroer out of, I think Nick is out of O'Fallon, Missouri, St. Charles County, I know, St. Charles County. The bill was filed several months ago. Now, currently, the bill is not in committee. What is currently going on is a lot of bills have been stalled because of the political dynamics in Jeff City. They're doing the Senate redistricting map. They're doing budget. It's a lot going on in our state right now as far as the legislature goes. So a lot of things are not being focused on, and things that are not necessarily helpful are being focused on. You know, that's a whole nother subject. But this bill is basically stalled at this time. Now, Representative Schroer is an national attorney, so he understands the issue. And he did, request that the bill go to a committee. But in Missouri, the Speaker of the House, which his name is Rob Vescovo, he is the person in charge of putting bills into committee. And he has not done that. And so actually 2 days ago, I put out a call to action to have the community call Representative Vescovo or either email him and ask him, can he please, you know, put the bill in a committee as the person who sponsored it has requested. And, you know, several people have called, you know, told us that they called and they emailed. One lady said that, you know, I called and as soon as they answered the phone, they sounded, you know, like they were mad because people were calling. You know, we basically got on their nerves. And so I was happy about that.
Yes, Michelle, what is that number you are asking people to call about this law, in support of the law? Proposed bill.
Yes, no problem. So Representative Vescovo, again, he is the Speaker of the House in Jefferson City. So his number is 573-751-3607. That's 573-751-3607. And he is the one person who is responsible for putting bills into committees. Bills cannot pass in our state if they're not referred to a committee. That's just the way our legislation works. So once a bill is referred to a committee, that committee, a smaller body of people, they may have a hearing on it or they may have some type of debate about it. And then later it goes to the larger body to be, you know, passed into law. But again, Mr. Vescovo has to refer it. And so we are, and we did, like I said, on Thursday, a lot of people called, and we encourage people to continue calling, continue speaking about this, because we all appreciate when, you know, people are exonerated. Last year when I got the call that Mr. Strickland was freed, I can't even tell you how many tears I cried. The man had been in prison 43 years. I'm 45 years old. So he literally went to prison shortly after I was born. So, you know, that was a very heart-wrenching situation. We were all so happy. And that is an amazing time when people are exonerated. But I really want to get across to the community, it's a systemic issue. It's not just one person every now and again who was wrongfully convicted. It happens very often. I talk to families all the time, you know, about how their family member was wrongfully convicted, like I said, most of the time because of informant testimony. Sometimes it's, you know, police or prosecutor misconduct. That also happens. But these things are serious issues that affect so many people, and I want people to have as much passion and concern in making sure that we get legislative change to help everybody as we do when one person comes home. And like last year, over $1 million was raised for Mr. Strickland on GoFundMe, which was amazing because he's been in prison most of his life, and he needs that plus more. And I definitely hope he gets more. But the fact that we need to make changes for everybody, there are so many reasons in Missouri that people are stifled from getting out of prison and proving themselves innocent. There are different precedents to set, different laws. Other states is a lot easier, like in Michigan. It's a lot easier to, get exonerated once you prove that you're innocent. California, of course. Even Texas. Right now, Texas has this law. It's easier to be exonerated in Texas than it is in Missouri. Texas has an informant reform law because they saw how many people were getting exonerated, and how many people wrongfully convicted. This was about 3 or 4 years ago. And, they had a commission and they studied it and they figured out that in Texas, informants account for the majority of the people who were wrongfully convicted. And so they took steps in that state to change things. So I really want, Missouri to follow the footsteps of several other states, including several conservative-leaning states.
Yeah, so because Texas is in the news a lot over women's rights and things like that. And I see, the governor of Missouri jumping in within 24 hours any time some kind of legislation is proposed in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
He's on Twitter. Yeah, I'm all about that. And so what do you think the governor's opinion is at this point?
I don't know, and I don't believe that this particular bill has gotten to that point to where it's, piqued his interest. I will say there was another bill concerning wrongful convictions that was proposed. It was concerning compensation for people who were exonerated. In this state, there was no compensation unless you were exonerated for DNA, and most people are not exonerated for DNA, which probably was why that was able to pass. But this session, someone did propose a bill to compensate people who were wrongfully convicted, regardless of what the reason was. And I recall the governor going on some media outlet and making a statement to where he didn't feel like the entire state should be responsible for paying a claim of someone who was wrongfully convicted and exonerated. He feel like, maybe that county or, the city that where it happened should be. And that was his stance on that. And I also know that last year when we were trying to uplift Mr. Strickland, the governor was not, receptive to it. Of course, it wasn't necessarily his call. However, he, made several statements about, you're convicted type of thing. But once Mr. Strickland was exonerated, he took credit for it because there was a law that was passed last year. Under that law, it was Senate Bill 53 that said that that prosecutors can bring, a court case if they find evidence of someone's innocence, which is how Mr. Strickland's case got in the court. So, of course, the governor took credit for signing that bill, even though he had, made statements about, he didn't necessarily think Mr. Strickland was innocent. So our governor definitely straddles the fence a lot in his views on certain things. But this particular bill, he has not, I don't think it's risen to that point to where he's made any comments about it. But like you said, whenever Texas does something, Missouri is right on their heels. So I'm, and when I found that Texas had passed informant legislation, actually they did it originally, I believe in 2018, and they improved those provisions in 2020. So they have a passed, they call them articles in Texas. They don't call them statutes. They passed several articles in Texas about informant reform. So I definitely want Missouri to, we're going to follow Texas in some things. Let's follow Texas in this, because this is something similar to Texas that we're very horrible at. So let's follow their footsteps as well. So that's definitely one point that I am, using to convince a lot of our conservative legislators and organizations. And I've had a lot of success and support from different conservative organizations and legislators, national organizations and local, because it's about justice. This is not a partisan issue. This is strictly about making sure that we're actually getting justice and not convicting people that didn't do, you know, the crime, making sure that the actual person who did it, you know, gets convicted for the crime and not an innocent person. So it's definitely a bipartisan issue for sure.
Now, let's talk about Oklahoma a little bit. I mean, that seems, I mean, we see executions in Oklahoma on the scale of Missouri. And it's just mind-boggling that Texas and Oklahoma have passed this legislation already. Go ahead. What about Oklahoma? How did they go about accomplishing this?
Well, there is an organization called ALEC. ALEC is the acronym, and I believe it stands for Legislative
Exchange
Council. I'm sorry, I'm not probably not saying the right the right product.
Michelle, I have it. It's called the American Legislative Exchange Commission.
ALEC, correct. And ALEC is an organization made up of, for the most part, conservative legislators all over the state. And what ALEC does is when one of their member legislators brings an issue to them, they do some research, you know, they get the stats, the statistics, and do research about it, and they either, you know, support it or not. And this particular issue, ALEC has supported. They put out something called a model policy. So if you go to their website, you can find ALEC model policy on different issues. And if it's an issue that you care about, there has been a conservative legislator somewhere in the country that has brought that issue to ALEC. They've done the research and they approve or agree with it, and then they support it. They are not necessarily a lobbying agency, but their member legislators, they get together and discuss different things, and that's how it passed in Texas, that's how it passed in Oklahoma and other states, because the legislators all over the country, the state legislators are part of ALEC. And so they get together and they, get together and have these discussions, basically like groups of legislators. And a lot, sometimes it's stuff I don't necessarily agree with, right? Everything that, you know, our conservative legislators support, I do not support. But when it comes to things of this nature, like criminal justice reforms, they have been supportive in several states. And, of course, that goes back to the First Step Act that Trump signed back in 2018. And, of course, we can disagree with a lot of things that Mr. Trump did. However, that particular legislation actually did help some people who were in federal prison and facing federal charges. So that particular issue of criminal justice reform is something that some of the conservative legislators, Republican, all over the country are getting on board. So, you know, I'm going to, appreciate that. Take it and keep going.
So this will help convictions in the future, and it will help. It will help get some people get out. Also, is that right?
Yes. Yeah, so the bill definitely would help, of course, people who are facing, you know, criminal charges, to make sure if the prosecutor brings in an informant, you know, that they use the person correctly and make sure that their information aligns. But also, it will help people who are already incarcerated, because they can refer to this statute when they are trying to get their case back in court. Right now, it's difficult for someone incarcerated in this state who, you know, is wrongfully convicted to get back in court. Even when, in the case of Mr. Chris Dunn, his judge actually said in 2020, "I see you're innocent, Mr. Chris Dunn, but I can't let you out because of the law." He literally could not release Chris. He thought he was innocent, but he couldn't release him because of different laws in Missouri, sadly. So this is one of those law, if we get it passed, that will actually help people who are already in prison, wrongfully convicted, to have another avenue to fight for their freedom, and then help people who, you know, would get arrested and go to court as well. So this is something that can help many, many people in our state.
Amazing. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, look, okay. I don't want to, like, totally I don't want you to wear your voice out because I know you got a busy week coming up. And tell us about the organizations that you that you're working with, and go ahead and any contact information that you have that you want to put out there. Can you go ahead and give us that?
Sure. So, and my name again is Michelle Smith. My actual position, I work for MADP, which is Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty. So my main role is to fight for the abolition of the death penalty in Missouri. And within my role, I do many other things because death penalty is connected to everything else. And I do community engagement. So I just engage our communities in different areas, whether it be local, governance, prosecutor issues, jail, prison conditions. There are so many things that are connected to that. And so that's, kind of the role that I do. So with this particular informant reform that we're trying to do, what I did was I created a campaign, and I called the campaign Mo Innocent. Like, Mo is the abbreviation for Missouri. So it's called hashtag Mo Innocent. And we're going to push for this informant reform bill. We're also going to push for some other legislation next year. And also uplift people who are wrongfully convicted. I would be remiss if I didn't say that in June 6th through the 10th, Mr. Lamar Johnson, who is a wrongfully convicted man from St. Louis, he is in prison. He's in Jeff City Correctional Center. But in June, he will have a evidentiary hearing the first week of June the 6th through the 10th. And so I'll be in Jeff City, being supportive for Lamar and his family, and we're probably going to have a rally. And so one other thing about our Mo Innocence campaign is to uplift the people who are wrongfully convicted, because most people only get on the news or get in, media when they're about to be released, like, Mr. Carnes, hopefully, or Mr. Strickland, or, Mr. Kidd. But the people who are sitting in prison wrongfully convicted, they have a voice too, and they need someone to support them. So the Mo Innocence campaign will support those who are wrongfully convicted, will uplift them as much as we can, and push for legislative reform to get these horrible laws changed, and to also create new laws that will help wrongfully convicted people. So people can get on Twitter or Facebook and search for the hashtag Mo Innocence. And I've been posting and sending out information on it a lot in the last month. We started about a month ago, and I'm just, working to make it as big as I possibly can. And also I'm hosting an event this Friday, yesterday, Saturday, so next Friday, April the 1st. It will be in Kansas City, and it'll be in St. Louis as well. The event in Kansas City will be at the Bluford Library, which is a corner of Prospect and 31st. And this is going to be a community event where we just bring people together in the community to talk about criminal justice issues, from jail to bail reform to the police to prison conditions to legislation. Just have a community conversation about what's going on in our cities and our state and how we can all come together to make a difference. Because, we all, people care about so many different issues, but we're going to have to unify and, get to Jeff City to deal with our elected officials to let them know what we really need in our local communities. And I know a lot of things are going on in Kansas City with they're trying to give the police, $80 million or something. Just a lot of things are going on with local control and the police. So these are just conversations we need to have. And I'm definitely looking forward to having it between St. Louis and Kansas City. So that event actually is called the Day of Empathy, and register, and we do ask people to register because we are providing lunch, and there is a limited seating because of COVID restrictions. We got to kind of make sure we don't fill the room, pack the room, but we're asking for people to register. So it's link to register is mo-doe-kc, and it's all capital letters. And, people can, of course, like I said, register for that and come and have these conversations and really, like I said, we need to unite and come together as a community to, you know, make our voices heard collectively.
Great, great. Well, I want to thank you for coming on, and believe me, we can let you talk for another 30 minutes, but I think you probably run a good
Carl?
You run a good 30 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah.
I Michelle, I have another question, and maybe you could help us.
Oh, okay.
The listeners out in the countryside. We're in the countryside. What mm-hmm. is this informant reform law? Could you review that again for us? And what will that do? Because there's no amount of always suspicion involved in people when they hear that there was a so-called jailhouse snitch involved in prosecuting people, putting people in jail. So could you mm-hmm. get into this? Once again, and we're listeners, we're talking about a Missouri State House Bill 2523, sponsored by Representative sure. Nick Shore, and it hasn't made it to the committee yet, and it may need your support to get it into the committee, because mm-hmm. that's any, and they'll tell you, people will tell you, anything in the committee, anything can happen too. So it's House Bill 2523 that our guest, Michelle Smith, is encouraging people to watch carefully, encourage it for passage through the process to be put before the vote of the House of Representatives in Missouri as a whole. So please describe this informant reform law that you're proposing. This is very interesting. I think a lot of people will support this.
Well, no problem. So I definitely will explain it a little bit more, and I actually am looking at the summary page. But I'm going to tell you a story because, of course, you know, people connect with stories that connect with a personal situation. There was a man
right.
in our state. It is a man. His name was David Robinson. Mr. Robinson was convicted in the Boot Hill area some years ago for a murder. Now, back at that time, Mr. Robinson apparently was some type of community troublemaker. From what I read, he got into petty crimes, you know, in his community. Nothing serious, but he had some petty crimes to where the police knew who he was. Of course, when you're a small town and you do anything, of course, the police, you know your name from then on. So in that particular community, there was a lady who was murdered. So the police decided to talk to David because they know David had done random, you know, little crimes in that community before. And they put David in jail. So by the time his court case came, there was an informant, and that this informant said, I was David's cellmate in jail, because again, they had David in jail. I was David's cellmate in jail, and he told me that he killed this lady, okay? And of course, this person wasn't there at the crime scene. You know, he didn't have any information like that, but he said David was in a cell with me, and he told me he did this, okay? So David was convicted basically based on that particular story and went to prison. And, of course, his family knew, you know, in their hearts that he didn't do it. So over the years, they, you know, just really tried to uplift David's story. And at some point, the paper down there is called Southeast Missourian. That's what the newspaper's called. So the newspaper decided to do a report on David's case, and actually they did a lot of investigative journalism over several years, and every few months they would do an updated story on, you know, on David, which it was some great journalism. And so what happened was they started sunshining, which is asking the police for different records and filing in court, and they got the jailhouse records, and guess what? That person had never been David's cellmate. He was in the jail. He had been in the jail, but he had never shared a cell with David. And we can understand that had the police looked and the prosecution looked, and it's David was in prison 18 years wrongfully convicted. Had they looked 18 years ago, once this person came and said, oh, he told me this, had they looked and said, okay, well, you're saying he told you, you were cellmates, and he told you he did this. It was in the jail records that the person was never David's cellmate. But they didn't care to look. They saw someone telling them a story. They wanted to convict David, and they went ahead and used this person's story. It didn't align with the evidence. And so that's what this bill would do. This bill would make sure that whatever a person is coming to say aligns with the evidence. And it would, you know, so with this, provisions of this bill would have a one provision, I'm sorry, it would be a pretrial reliability hearing where the judge would bring the informant in and say, okay, you're saying in that situation, David told you he did this. Okay, well, we looked in records and you weren't his cellmate, so what's going on? It should not have taken David 18 years to get out of prison from that. That should have been known and should have been discovered 18 years before, but it wasn't. So those particular types of stories is why we need reform in the usage of, you know, these particular snitches or jailhouse informants or CIs or whatever term we want to call these people. That David's story is a perfect example of how it went wrong and how we need to fix it. And so I often, you know, just kind of recount his story as a quick anecdote. But the particular provisions of the bill, and this is on the summary page, one is to establish a statewide record system that will be maintained by the Department of Public Safety, but that this record system would track informant testimonies and the benefits offered by the prosecutor to that person. So if a person has informed on 10 people before, there will be a system where the judge can go in and say, okay, this person has been informant on 10 other cases. This is some information the jury needs to know because it goes to their credibility. Because if you're always around when somebody do something or you always know the inside of somebody committing a crime, that's a little fishy. Like, why are you always the one to know these things? So there will be a database tracking system of these people and their testimony. That's one thing. And other states have this, including Texas. Other states have developed a tracking system, you know, to track these testimonies of these people. Another provision would be to make available to the court information about that person testifying, including their criminal history, any benefits offered now or in the future. And any other cases that they have testified on. So again, those things about who that person is and, you know, why they would be coming to testify. I also want to make sure, let me stop really quick. An informant is different from a witness, and I don't want people to misconstrue the two. I don't want, you know, people who live in a neighborhood, maybe an older lady down the street saw something and she just wants to tell the police what happened because it was a horrible thing. That's not an informant. That woman doesn't have any benefit. She doesn't have any incentive. She's not being coerced by the police. She's just a neighbor down the street who happened to, you know, come outside and see something. So there are differences between a witness and an informant. An informant has some type of an incentive or benefit, whether it be monetary, time off of their own sentence. A lot of times police will say, if you don't tell me this, I'm going to charge you with something. You know, I'm going to charge you with the drugs if you don't tell on your friend. So those people are what's considered an informant. So make sure we, you know, don't confuse what's a witness and what's an informant. Another thing is the summary says is the pretrial reliability hearings, again, that the judge would have with that particular person. And something else, like I spoke of before, notifying the victim of the informant whatever benefit they're getting in time off of their sentence. Because if someone did something to you when they got, for instance, a five-year sentence, but they're in jail informing on other people and getting time off, and all of a sudden they're out of jail after 6 months, and you're the victim and you thought they were going away for 5 years of what they did to you, and, you know, the victims don't know why. Right now, the police or prosecutors don't tell them why their perpetrator got all of this time off of their sentence. It's just the person's out of prison now. And so that's not okay because, you know, that particular person had a right to be notified of what happened, you know, in their case as well. So all of these provisions is what would bring some accountability, some transparency to using informants. Now, there is no situation where they would go to jail. There's no punitive part of this. This is just the usage of someone. So if in David's case, for instance, if the prosecutor had looked that 18 years before and after that person said, David told me this, we were cellmates. If the prosecutor had looked and saw that they weren't cellmates, he just didn't have to use that person's testimony. That was, you know, because he hadn't testified yet. There was no perjury charge because he had not actually gotten on the, you know, on the stand and trial yet. So there would be nothing to do with him other than saying, hey, I'm not using you. I don't believe you're telling the truth. Go away. And that would have been that. So this bill is not saying that anybody's going to be charged with anything or any type of punitive issues. It's just about the usage of them and if the prosecutors should be able to use that person's testimony in a court case.
So we're talking, listeners, we're talking about how Missouri State House, Jefferson City, Missouri House Bill 2523, sponsored by Representative Nick Shore, for the informant reform law or bill that is proposed. It's got a long ways to go. I've got a sidebar question for you, Michelle, also a follow-up. You know, I'm surprised that there isn't any mention that in the bill that there is some sort of a verification of the informant statement, because a lot of times these jailhouse informants, especially as you eloquently pointed out, that there is, you know, there's this thing of what is hearsay, and I'm surprised that I know in the case of many street informants that it is almost required by judges for admissibility of the statement to have some sort of electronic surveillance placed, like they have to wear a tape recorder or the proximity of where the conversation allegedly takes place, incriminating the defendant is wired, or there's a eavesdropping device placed so that the conversation, the most incriminating conversation, is there's some verification other than just a written statement by some guy who alleges he's a cellmate and this is what was said and what was said by the at the time. I mean, that is just, that is really a big problem in criminal justice reform, I think. But what do you think?
Yeah.
There's nothing in that. I guess in House Bill 2523 doesn't have that kind of stipulation. I think it would be interesting to see what the Missouri representatives would say about that, the necessity of some sort of independent verification, electronically or otherwise. What do you think of that, Michelle?
Well, exactly. Yeah, exactly. And actually, that would be covered in the pretrial reliability hearing, where the judge would determine whether the testimony of the informant is reliable. It wouldn't be something in front of the jury, but it would be, you know, a side hearing where the judge would need that verification that you're talking about, making sure that that story aligns. I think the hearsay thing is, a lot of times they feel like they have other evidence, like in David's case. They feel like they had other evidence, right. You know, like I said, he had done other things. I robbed houses. I don't know what he did, but he did a lot of other things where they thought it was similar to that situation. So I think a lot of times they feel like they have a pattern with that particular person that's on trial, and so this informant is coming and verifying that particular pattern of whatever they're trying to use. So a lot of times it really is just, you know, just coming in and saying something that they assume anyway. The police thought that David did it. They before, you know, the person came, because the fact that David was in jail, they already thought David did it to have put him in jail. So that's, uh-huh. You know, they really didn't have anything. I think David had did burglaries or houses in the past, from what I recall. So they knew that David had did things like that. So this woman obviously was killed doing some type of robbery at her house. So they thought they had a pattern of a behavior on him already, and that's what they had him in jail for. So it was like, oh, you're saying he was your cellmate and he told you he did it? Okay, so we already have some circumstantial evidence that where we feel, you know, proves that he did it. So this is just icing on the cake. So it should be more actual proof of the stories that people are giving, when you're saying that you were with somebody or you saw somebody do something, in Keith Horns' case, the man in Kansas City, his informant said she saw Keith shoot this the young man who died, who was murdered. She saw Keith shoot this person. There was nothing. She was in the vicinity. She was a person that was in the vicinity of this happening, but there was nothing other than her saying, "I saw Keith shoot this person," that proved anything. Literally nothing. But the police already felt like, you know, Keith did it. You know, Keith was at that point, I believe, selling drugs, and this person who had some type of issue with him because of that. And so they already felt like he did something. So it doesn't take a whole lot of, you know, that extra proof and all that when the police have their own, you know, assumptions of what happened. They're just going to go with the flow. And once the person comes forth, say, "Oh, yeah, I saw that happen. I saw them do that. Oh, you did? Let's go." Now, if there was a defense witness, like I said earlier, they would have asked a million questions, you know, figured out where you were, talk to your family. They would have done way more if there was a defense witness testifying for someone, but because there was a prosecution witness, her saying, "I saw Keith shoot somebody," was enough to, you know, obviously convict him. And there was another lady who said the same thing, but she has said since then that she was coerced. So again, informants, there are people who are coerced. There are people who are scared. You know, the prosecution or police say, "I'm going to charge you with this if you don't tell me this." So there are sometimes it's a fear that people have to where they are, you know, telling these stories. And sadly that happened as well in his case. It was a lot going on in Mr. Corns' case. But I definitely understand what you're saying. But the pretrial reliability hearing that the judge would conduct is something that would address all of those issues. And it would be up to the judge to make sure that whatever that informant is coming to say, that he actually vets it better than the prosecutor, because the prosecutor has a, you know, motive. They're trying to get a conviction. The judge is supposed to be a neutral party. It doesn't always happen like that, but technically in our jurisprudence system, the judge is supposed to be a neutral party and actually supposed to look at what the evidence is and making sure that story aligns with actual the crime that occurred. So. And I also want to say, I'm sorry, I want to add one more thing about this issue and this particular bill. This is the first year it has been sponsored. I'm not a paid lobbyist. I'm not someone who is connected to anybody in our state legislature. And just being honest, I've been a prisoner twice myself. I am a poor black woman from the city of St. Louis. And so even getting this bill to this point, it took a lot. I had to talk to a lot of people. Some of the people I've met, you know, I'm like, "Can you connect me to these other people?" And people see my passion for this work, and that's how I've gotten it to this point. Now, because this is a bill's first year, most bills don't pass in their first year unless it's something that, you know, the very powerful people in our state capitol are pushing. But if it's just, you know, bills that the community wants, or a bill of a legislator who, you know, may be new or something along that line, bills don't normally pass the first year. But we did get, you know, bill number this year. We are trying to get a hearing. We're trying to get it in a committee so that it can have a hearing. We have people exonerated and families who want to come and speak. There are two men in Kansas City who were on death row who have been exonerated, Mr. Joe Amrine and Mr. Reggie Griffin. And they would like to come and speak. They were on death row. People on death row are also innocent. You know, wrongful convictions happens to everybody. And there are people who this country has killed, executed, that were innocent. Joe and Reggie could have been executed. Thankfully, they had a legal team that fought, and they were eventually exonerated. We have another man on our death row right now. His name is Mr. Marcellus Williams. He's out of St. Louis. He is innocent. And I don't say that because, you know, he is our client or he's on death row. There has been evidence presented to our governor that proves Marcellus is innocent. And we're waiting on the governor to, you know, make a hopefully make a move and let him out of prison. So I just say that to say that this particular law, it is new. This is the first year, but we're trying to, you know, push it to as far as it can go, hopefully to a committee and a hearing. But if it doesn't pass, and, you know, I'm realistic on that, it possibly won't pass this year. We're going to keep introducing it every year until it actually passes, because this is something we really need. The bill last year that they passed for prosecutors to file, that those cases, when they see someone wrongfully convicted, which is why Mr. Strickland got in court, that was great. And, you know, but the issue is only prosecutors can use it. And right now, no one else has used it other than Ms. Peters Baker for Mr. Strickland. There is no other prosecutor in this state that has used that law. They're supposed to, but they haven't, because, you know, it's up to their discretion. And that can be problematic. But this particular bill about the informant reform, it is something that people who are incarcerated themselves wrongfully and people who are in trial, they can use on their own behalf. They don't have to go, you know, and ask a prosecutor to do it. There have been families who have been begging prosecutors to file that law for their family members, and they have not, because everything is political for them. And so,
yes,
you know, this particular... Yeah, exactly. So this bill will, you know, be for people to use on their own. So, again, I don't necessarily think it's going to pass this year, but I appreciate Representative Schroer filing it, and I'm just going to build a coalition, you know, this year and next year, and hopefully next year we can get it filed again and get it passed, because it's desperately, desperately needed. So I definitely want people to keep up with me and what I'm doing. My organization, actually, if you want to go and support our org, it's MADPMO on social media. So Missourians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, MADP and MO for Missouri is our social handle. So people can find me online under that. And I'm just really trying to build a coalition and trying to raise the consciousness of our state. There are so many people who are wrongfully convicted, and families, they don't know where to turn. They don't know where to go. You know, they call the Innocence Project. And the Innocence Project is a great organization. They can only do so much. You know, there's capacity, you know, for everybody. If there are, you know, 100 people wrongfully convicted only in Missouri, Innocence Project in our area, they have 5 states. So they literally cannot help everybody. So I feel like if we get legislative reform that can help more people, then that'll go further than an attorney helping one particular person, which that's great, and we do celebrate that as well. But we need a holistic approach to dealing with wrongful convictions, because it is a systemic problem.
I agree with there. Where I'm at in Jefferson County, Missouri, or excuse me, Jefferson County, Kansas, the case that made national headlines involving Floyd Bledsoe, the Innocence Project played a significant role in exonerating Mr. Bledsoe after he was incarcerated for, I think, over 16 years, since 1999. And he was exonerated. And it was quite an uproar in the state government and state house, because they, from the local county sheriff all the way up, they were all basically just rode along with whatever conviction was given, even after a huge stink. Floyd was released, and he was at that time in the state of Kansas. There was no laws that would adequately compensate him, and it was to the credit of one of the detective sergeant. To the credit of a detective sergeant in this county, in Jefferson County, who was not involved in the Bledsoe murder in 1999, but he was elected as a state in the House. He was elected in the House of Representatives. And his name is Ramon Gonzalez, and he got elected, and he forced a compensation law for people who are wrongfully convicted in through the state house, and it took about a year and a half, 2 years before it got through. I'm just informing people in Kansas about Michelle Smith's effort here with Missouri House Bill 2523. So Floyd, he got out practically penniless. Now, people knew he was, people were going to help him through GoFundMe, but he was nothing. I mean, it was after years. It was a long time, and his brother was the actual murderer, and it took his brother committing suicide. Now, I don't want to dwell on this too long. His brother committed suicide and wrote a note. Now, that opened up a probable cause for them to reopen Floyd, the brother's who was in prison, case for the Innocence Project, and that's where they discovered the DNA evidence that proved that his brother, the murderer, was who had committed suicide, was actually part of the crime scene, and not Floyd. So it is a mess in our criminal justice system to get exonerated, to get out, and to be compensated for those many years that you were held in prison. In Kansas, it's very slow, but it's happening. And Kansas is dominated by ALEC, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Committee. It probably grew out of this state in that sense. And it's a very dour, conservative lot. Listen, there's many corporations that have dominated the lawmaking done throughout the country. They write up these bills and send them through. A lot of the corporations' bills go right through, and every state house gets them and stuff. It's very notorious. It's to your credit, Michelle Smith, that you got the ear and at least maybe tepid or lukewarm support of conservative lawmakers within the ALEC, ALEC. That's to your credit, by the way. I consider that. So,
well, thank you very much.
You.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's very hard to work at this level that you're doing, and I understand that totally, especially when you're not a lobbyist, which, by the way, many, many, many people would consider that to your credit, that you're not a lobbyist. And
and that's the thing. We need to be the regular people, the regular citizens, all of the state. We need to be lobbyists. Of course, we're not getting paid the big bucks that those professionals are,
right,
but we definitely need to lobby for ourselves and our issues, in our state capital.
Well, it better informs the citizens to get involved. I've never ran into a citizen yet who goes to the state house, hasn't been there since they were a kid in grade school, when it was like a field trip. I've ran into many, many people. It's hard to believe, but it's true. Many, many people do not get involved in their state and learning and understanding how the state, how the process of it, let alone the pitfalls and the problems that are involved in getting it. And Floyd Bledsoe was a big deal out here. The Bledsoe murder case was very big. It involved, over half of the county sheriff's department are on lists for lawsuits because of their, for lack of better terms, prosecutorial misconduct. Even the KBI, the Kansas Bureau of Investigation, involved in it. And it was a very big case around here. It was a big black eye for the county and for all of us who lived out here, longtime citizens. And it's like, many people suspected that there was something going on in that case that, did they get the right guy, Floyd? Many suspected that it was Tom, because it was Tom, it was his brother's gun that was, ballistics proved it was his brother's gun that committed the homicide of this 14-year-old girl, by the way. Yeah.
I saw another case out of
finish this. They buried They buried this poor 14-year-old girl in their farm, in a brush pile, basically a dump that they all used at their farm. It was horrible. It was a horrible murder.
Wow.
And Floyd was he was not involved in it. And he ended up, he was the most concerned trying to find out where this young lady was at, and they convicted him of it, and his brother, whose gun it was whose DNA proved he was there, was with this young lady, and killed her. Later it took years, decades, I don't know, more than 14, 15 years before this finally came to daylight, to public. So people need to pay attention to this stuff. Yeah, I'm speaking from Jefferson County where that happened, and I totally understand where you're going with this, Michelle. You got my support, sister.
Well, thank you. And actually, I was just thinking about when you mentioned Kansas, Mr. P. Coon. His case is out of Kansas as well. And in Kansas, they tried to get an informant reform law because of his case. It's something his family was pushing. It didn't pass last year, and this year I'm not quite sure if they tried to file it again. But I know that in Kansas they are trying to do an informant reform deal because, you know, Mr. Coons was in prison, and he died, I believe, 3 or 4 months after his release, his exoneration. He died shortly after.
Uh-huh.
This is one reason his family is pushing this, because they lost, you know, those years with him, his last 2 years, they lost because of this problem, and this injustice is what it is. So, yeah, they are also trying to push the bill in Kansas, and as far as I know, it hasn't passed, but, you know, we need these. Now, 10 states have laws about informant reform, and we need, of course, all the states to have it, but currently 10 states. And I want to just leave the audience with one more thing. Information is key. There is a website called snitching.org. There's a book called Snitching. It's a professor out of California. She did some research and wrote this book, and she created a website. So it's called snitching.org, and it lists a lot of information, like different states that have passed these laws, other states that have tried it, different court cases. It's just a great resource for people who really want to understand, you know, informants and the issues that these people have caused over our entire country for many, many decades. So, yeah, snitching.org is an amazing website. And then I get my data from another website called the National Registry of Exonerations. And the University of Michigan, they started the database in 1989, and every person who is exonerated in this country, they put them on database. And right now there's over 3,000 people that they've tracked. And sadly, these over 3,000 people, they lost over 27,000 years of their life to being wrongfully convicted. And that's a horrible, horrible number. Mr. Strickland, that came home last year, 43 years, was one of the longest serving people. But a few months later, someone named Vincent Simmons, I believe in Louisiana, he was exonerated. He was in prison for 44 years. So being wrongfully convicted literally is taking people's entire lives. And it is the ultimate injustice.
Thank you. Thank you. Carl, do you have any closing statements or questions for Michelle Smith?
Let's talk about your social media. You say you're on all social media platforms?
That's right. So my organization, I normally have people follow my organization because that's where we put all of the work we're doing. The at symbol, and it's MADPMO. So MADPMO on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And we have an amazing tech person who, you know, she is great with the social media and all our communications. Also, our website is MADPMO. If you want to go to our website, you can definitely follow the work we're doing, sign up to get our newsletter, and to keep updated on the work. We do a lot of lobby training for regular people because we need to know how to fight for ourselves. So we will do training, you know, about how to lobby our legislators, you know, kind of what to say. People get nervous when they're talking to these people, you know, these quote-unquote important people. So we talk to them often about, you know, what to say. You know, educate people on the different laws that are being proposed and what we can do to advocate. So we are one of the only statewide organizations that do that, and we are the only statewide death penalty abolition organization. So So we have a lot going on, and, you know, we support people all over the state. Currently, the man that is on death row who is scheduled to be executed May 3rd, his name is Carmen Deck. Carmen was abused severely as a child, starved, sexually abused. Just a plethora of abuse this person endured as a child. And he grew up, you know, he did something very bad, and he currently is on death row. And we definitely feel for the victim's family as well, but we just feel like when we, you know, just throw away children, you know, he's a child being neglected and nobody helped him, including the school. So when we throw away people like that, and then they do something, it's almost like society just gets rid of people, which is very sad. So we're fighting for Carmen, and we're fighting for people wrongfully convicted. It's just a fight. Fight for justice. So that's what we're doing.
Excellent. And Michelle Smith, Missouri for Alternative Death Penalty, MADPMO. You can find him on Twitter, whatever your favorite social media is. Thank you, Michelle.
Thank you. You all have a good night.
All right. Mike, let's go ahead and play clip 340, and this is the Channel 5 interview of Michelle Smith.
The witness. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, that's cool. All right, and then we'll take it from there. Okay, right on. And thanks for bringing her on. I'm sure a lot of people will get a lot of benefit out of this, out of what the work she's doing. She's doing a lot. She's biting off a lot. A lot of things
that's
going
amazing.
On there, isn't there?
Yeah, amazing,
it amazing
work. Yeah.
Really.
All right, hit it,
so
Mike.
Here she is, I guess. Here's the Michelle Smith on Channel 5.
Citizens News 5's Morgan Mobley gives us a closer look at the Informant Reliability Act and how it could help overturn wrongful convictions.
Over 60% of exonerated innocent people have been convicted because of informant testimony and false accusations. That's according to the National Registry of Exonerations data. Michelle Smith has been in the courtroom for several of these cases in Missouri and is actively working to change that statistic.
This bill actually addresses the systemic nature of wrongful convictions and how they come about, which is through informants.
Smith helped write House Bill 2523, also known as the Informant Reliability Act, the focus, transparency, and accountability.
So there would be pretrial reliability hearings where the judge brings in the informant and make sure that whatever testimony they're giving aligns with the actual evidence in the case. Transparency in the prosecution, letting the jury and the judge know whatever deal possible is, because there are incentives. So whatever incentive or deal the informant is getting.
Smith says one of her inspirations behind creating this bill is the case of Keith Carnes. He's been locked up since 2003. Informants in his case say he shot and killed a man in the parking lot of that restaurant right there, but the bullet casings were only found right next to that yellow home.
The fact that police jumped through 20 hoops to say that this person was telling the truth, if that had been a defense witness, they would have obliterated her story because it had 20 holes in it. But because she was a prosecution witness, they bought it hook, line, and sinker.
Senate Bill 53, which allows prosecutors to reopen cases, was a key piece of legislation that helped set Kevin Strickland free last November. But Smith believes this bill could be even more impactful.
It's for everyone. It's not dependent on prosecutors to file. It is something that the person incarcerated on trial can use to make sure that they receive a fair trial.
10 other states have passed this legislation, including Texas and Oklahoma. Smith says the time is now to bring it to Missouri.
Stealing people's lives and putting them in prison and not actually holding the real person accountable is a problem.
In Kansas City, Morgan Mobley, KCTV 5 News.
Thank you. should have done your side. Never thought I'd have to feel so lonely after such a long, long time. Time out of mind. Baby, bad love, shadow love, random love, and abandoned love. Accidentally, like a martyr. The hurt gets worse, and the heart gets harder. Leave it, man. Like a martyr. The hurt gets worse, the heart gets harder.
And we're back. It's 8:16 in the Midwest. And we enjoyed Michelle Smith and doing all that amazing work. And we got Lobby Day coming up in April. Every April is Lobby Day at your Capitol. So you can contact ACLU Kansas, ACLU Missouri, and we usually take a bus from St. Louis and Kansas City, and then we meet up in the middle, and we walk around, and we visit the state representatives' offices and admire their little knickknacks that they have on their desk that show their political preference. And I'll give you a report back. Because y'all recall I myself witnessing Missouri State Highway Patrolman goose stepping like Italian fascist with a senator, and
you can go to Topeka and admire how clean and everything is, all the fancy furniture and the chandeliers, and it's
opulent.
Goose stepping aside, Carl. I mean,
it's opulent. I mean, granted, the Missouri Capitol got hit by a tornado, but and so that did some damage. But I did not recognize they changed the routing of the streets, and there's the Mel Carnahan Memorial Plane Crash Garden.
Oh God.
We can talk about that if you like, but we'll go on. And James Kirkpatrick, there's a tribute, but it's like, am I in Shangri-La? What's going on? I didn't realize these people were Buddhists around here. Or maybe Baptists. But yeah, I just didn't expect, you know, because we hear about all this conservative government coming out of Missouri, and you sure don't think about that, by looking at their landscape budget.
Right.
I mean, they're not spending that much on the golf course at the country club 2 miles away.
They didn't tell the people in Kansas on our side of the line. They didn't tell people that part of the $430 million, which really was, let's just call it, it was a half billion with a B, $500 million to remodel the state house. They didn't. I don't think many people realized that now the state lawmakers can go in and drive up, and I think it's on Kansas Avenue. It's one of the, you know, the Capitol buildings in a square, is like in a square, you know, it's surrounded by streets in the middle of a square. And there's this one hole that has guardrails around it. And every morning when the lawmakers come to work, they disappear. Their vehicles, if they come in, they just pull in and just disappear in this hole, literally a hole on the side of the street by the state capitol, the state house. And that hole takes them to a multi-level, I think it's four, maybe six floors, a parking garage underneath the state capitol building. It's literally, it could double as a massive, I guess that maybe they got a grant, or no, they made us pay for it, a massive, like a shelter that you could probably stuff 250,000 people in underneath the damn thing. And it's a parking space that they built underneath it for the thing. I just want to let people know, I know where the tax money goes.
I want to know how that elevator works, gets along with the salt treatment on the roads in the wintertime.
Oh, I have no idea. It's not an elevator. It's a ramp. They don't have to stop. There's a gate that just automatically flies open, you know, a single pole gate that just flies open when they approach it, and they just drop, they just zip right down in this hole. I called it a rabbit hole one time when I was standing there watching it. Like a rabbit hole, you know, they just literally just drop down in it. There's no elevator. It's an amazing, they spend a lot of money. I mean, well, $500 million all in that one little block, you know, of Topeka where underneath the state house, you know, it's amazing. So are you going to tell me to hit it, Carl? Or are we going to hit it onto the next subject here? I think it's,
this is 3:41, and we're going to talk about the fentanyl overdoses in Kansas and the Good Samaritan law.
Celia Yopis-Jepson of the Kansas News Service reports on steps that an increasing number of states are taking to prevent overdose deaths.
Seth Dewey works for the Reno County Health Department in Hutchinson, and his job is all about fighting the opioid epidemic.
In September of 2020, I received a phone call from someone who uses drugs, and they said, Seth, we need Narcan over here right now. And I was like, oh, crap.
The caller's friend had overdosed. Narcan or naloxone could mean the difference between survival and death. Dewey grabbed his kit, promised to rush over, and told them to call 911.
But he was scared to. And so I said, well, listen, then I'm going to call 911, so do what you got to do. When I got there, I ended up having to use three doses of naloxone on this individual and do CPR for 4 minutes while waiting, and it brought back a very slow labored breathing. First people on the scene, law enforcement. They did not have naloxone.
To Dewey, this story illustrates two things Kansas could do to save lives. First, equip more first responders with naloxone. The police in his area do carry it now, but lots of law enforcement agencies still don't. In February, a federal commission on the opioid epidemic urged Congress to help with the cost so that more first responders have it. Second, Kansas could soon be the last state without a Good Samaritan law for calling 911. Those laws mean you won't get arrested for using drugs when you call an ambulance to save a friend's life. And the U.S. Government Accountability Office says there's evidence that Good Samaritan laws do save lives, but ideas that can be seen as potentially soft on crime aren't popular in the Kansas legislature, even though Kansas police departments and sheriff's offices want this law. More than 90,000 people died of drug overdoses in the U.S. in 2020. It was a record, and the preliminary counts for 2021 look even worse.
The nation's opioid epidemic has never been deadlier.
Cheryl Jouer has lost not one, but two sons to overdose deaths.
The opioid crisis may be far worse than initially thought.
The trend is the same in Kansas. A lot of it has to do with opioids, like fentanyl. Just a few grains of it can kill you. Dealers mix it into other drugs to make them more potent and addictive. John Siebert sees this a lot. He's a doctor who treats people for addiction at Valley Hope in Atchison.
You have a patient buying a street drug, and they think they're buying, you know, cocaine, methamphetamine.
Or this situation.
The commonest way people are buying fentanyl now, you know, if I ask them on admission, hey, what brought you to Valley Hope? What's going on? The typical answer is they'll say, well, I'm doing Oxy 30s.
That is, they thought they were taking 30 milligram pills of oxycodone. Then they come to Valley Hope for treatment. They do a drug screening, and that's when some of them learn they've been taking fentanyl. And that can really scare them.
The word causes fear, right? I mean, just it's been the news enough that people realize what a deadly substance it is.
Seth Dewey in Reno County says that's why things like Good Samaritan laws and naloxone supplies are so important. Studies show most people do eventually achieve long-term recovery from drug addiction, but that can take years.
We're losing too many people due to this old idea that people have to hit rock bottom. People aren't getting a chance to hit rock bottom because they're dying.
That's why he also hopes Kansas will pass a law to legalize fentanyl test strips. These are kits that let people check whether there's fentanyl in the drugs they buy. The Federal Commission on the Opioid Epidemic thinks distributing them is the way to go. But in Kansas, they're illegal. The Kansas House passed a bill to change that, but the Senate hasn't held a hearing yet. For the Kansas News Service, I'm Celia Yobis-Jepson.
The Kansas News Service is a collaboration of KCUR, KMUW, Kansas Public Radio, and High Plains Public Radio. It reports on health, the many factors that influence it, and their connection to public policy.
We're back. It's 8:30 p.m. Saturday night. Is there a better place to be than Kansas City on a Saturday night? Okay, we're going to go to the Pentagon black budget and work this in the to our mass incarceration topic tonight. So this is 3:43, Mike. Hit it if you can. So
that's not the number. You have to wait a minute. Hold on. All right, here we go.
What you need to do, given the economic trouble we find ourselves in this country, is to make intelligent choices of how we spend our money. And we cannot write a blank check to the Pentagon or to the intelligence agencies. There has to be some level of informed debate about the level of spending secret weapons and secret programs soak up in this country. Let me give you an example. I'm able to write about and we're able to discuss the stealth bomber because it's been partly declassified after 10 years of secret research and development. Now, we have at this hour, as we speak on the 18th of September, a serious need for defense strength in the Persian Gulf. The stealth bomber, designed for nuclear war against the Soviet Union, is so expensive that one of them would support an entire division of troops in the Saudi desert for a year. You've got to have...
Which costs how much?
$900 million. You've got to be able to make intelligent choices. We're going around the world with our hat in our hand seeking money from foreign governments to support this mission because we have dedicated so much of our treasure, so much of our brain power, and would that could happen. But it does not. It is not the case. There is and will continue to be a struggle between the desire of the executive branch to increase its powers under the national security vision first framed in the early days of the Cold War and the desire of elected representatives for greater disclosure. This is what makes democracy a wonderful dogfight, is this continuing tug of war. The vision of comity that will allow just the right amount of secrecy out that Mr. Corbyn visions is not the way things are.
You wrote your newspaper articles in 88?
They were published in 87.
In 87.
Mm-hmm.
You now have a book in 1990.
Right.
You say you got a couple of prizes, one out of this particular one, the Pulitzer
mm-hmm.
Prize. Has there been any other tangible
result
on the...
You know, I hope so, and I would not attribute it to my articles back in 87, but to a slew of other reporting by a cadre of reporters and to the Iran-Contra investigation itself. I think that we go through cycles of corruption and reform in this country, and that what happened when the Iran-Contra affair fell apart was that we saw, and this was the conclusion of the majority report of the Iran-Contra committees, that I believe their phrase was a cabal of zealots had stolen a great deal of political power in this country, and they attributed their theft of that constitutional power to excessive secrecy. I think that that was an accurate analysis, and I think that now, as we begin by consensus to push some of these weapons programs into the light, to examine them for what they are, that an intelligent result will occur. But you cannot argue about stuff that's classified at the level that the stealth bomber was. You cannot debate it, and so decisions get made without sufficient information. Programs tend to perpetuate themselves without informed debate.
How much of all of what you're talking about in the black budget should be kept secret no matter what?
Intelligence sources and methods. You don't want, for example, to know that a head of state is on the CIA's payroll.
Are there many?
Well, in the 70s, Jordan's King Hussein was on the CIA's payroll. That's been publicly acknowledged by the United States government. You don't want to disclose the ways in which intelligence is gathered, because that will cut off the flow of the intelligence. What you need to do, given the economic trouble we find ourselves in this country, is to make intelligent choices of how we spend our money. And we cannot write a blank check to the Pentagon or to the intelligence agencies. There has to be some level of informed debate about the level of spending secret weapons and secret programs soak up in this country. Let me give you an example. I'm able to write about and we're able to discuss the stealth bomber because it's been partly declassified after 10 years of secret research and development. Now, we have at this hour, as we speak on the 18th of September, a serious need for defense strength in the Persian Gulf. The stealth bomber, designed for nuclear war against the Soviet Union, is so expensive that one of them would support an entire division of troops in the Saudi desert for a year. You've got to have...
Which costs how much?
$900 million. You've got to be able to make intelligent choices. We're going around the world with our hat in our hand seeking money from foreign governments to support this mission because we have dedicated so much of our treasure, so much of our brain power to these highly costly, dubiously valued nuclear war technologies. We can now, because of its declassification, debate whether we need a stealth bomber. But there are 100 other nuclear war technologies buried in the black budget about which there can be no debate.
100 others?
Related nuclear war technologies.
Give us an example.
Well, one that's just peeking its nose out into the light is the MILSTAR satellite system, which I write about at length in Blank Check.
By the way, before you explain that, when was the last word written for this book?
The afterword was rewritten in May of 1990.
And previous to that, when did you stop writing the book?
About a year ago, the fall of 1989, and I made minor revisions for clarity and updates while the book was being edited by the publisher.
Why did it take so long to get the book out?
It always takes 9 months from the submission of a manuscript, or it traditionally takes 9 months from the submission of a manuscript to the appearance of a book.
Anybody ever tell you why? I heard that so often. What's the 9 month thing?
It beats me. It's a baffling process. Perhaps it goes back to the gestation of a fetus in the womb.
We'll come back to MILSTAR in just a second. This book is published by Warner Books.
Correct.
At $21.95.
Correct.
If you could have, would you have changed anything in here after what happened over in the Gulf? Did that have any impact on, I mean, in other words, I'm getting at, people go buy this book today, it'll be out of date in any way.
Oh, no, I don't think so. The weapon systems that I discuss in the book are weapon systems geared for a full-tilt nuclear war against the Soviet Union. Those weapon systems still exist. They're still in the budget. We continue to build them as if the events of the last 18 months had never happened. Congress, as we speak, is weighing the value of these programs. But I believe that the information is fresh, and the events of the last 6 weeks in the Persian Gulf in no way alter the facts or the conclusions.
I'm sorry, MILSTAR.
Okay. A classic example of a military system developed under the black budget. It's now just been declassified enough so that we can discuss it intelligently. MILSTAR is an acronym. It's short for the Military Strategic Tactical and Relay System. Imagine the network as a constellation of 8 to 10 satellites in space in geosynchronous orbit 22,300 miles from Earth, linked by 3,000 to 4,000 ground stations on Earth, kind of computer terminals, broadcast dishes. The purpose of MILSTAR is to enable the survivors of the National Command Authority, the president and his top military aides, the survivors of the first days and weeks of a nuclear war, to continue to broadcast the go codes and launch orders for the firing of nuclear weaponry after the Pentagon, after the White House, after Washington, after Strategic Air Command headquarters in Omaha are destroyed. MILSTAR would weave together our fragmented forces so that the war envisioned could continue and the United States would emerge victorious from a six-month nuclear war. That was the design requirement under which MILSTAR was built. And its cost, once you include the cost of the rockets to launch the satellites and the various reconfigurations of the electronic network, will be somewhere in the $30 to $40 billion range.
Why is it becoming public?
Because it, A, is so expensive that it's very difficult to hide in the black budget. The request for next year's appropriation is more than $1 billion. Two, it has to be sold because it is controversial, because it is tremendously expensive. It has to be sold in the political marketplace. It has to be sold to Congress as a whole. This was the case with the Strategic Defense Initiative, Star Wars. Star Wars was largely kept out of the black world, although some of its component parts are very highly classified, because it was so radical a notion that it had to be sold in the political marketplace. This is why many people in the Pentagon don't like black programs, because you can't talk about them, you can't sell them, and it's inimical to good science to have compartmentalization of different parts of a very complicated military program.
While we're in the third world, I'm going to run down this number I wrote for Philip Habib. Haven't heard from the man. I hope he likes it. Attacking the Iraqis, the Syrians.
All right, we're back. It's 8:45 p.m. in Kansas City. That was the envoy, Warren Zevon. That song got him censored by CBS, and they took those records off the shelf. Apparently, Warren Zevon knew a little bit too much. And we'll talk about that a little bit later, maybe on another show. But if Mike's still around, how about 3:47? And we're going to talk about...
Welcome to Movement Memos, a Truth Out podcast about things you should know if you want to change the world. I'm your host, writer and organizer, Kelly Hayes. We talk a lot on this show about movement building, abolishing prisons, and the need to end capitalism before it ends us. Today, we are going to hear about a hunger strike organized by imprisoned people in California. And we are also going to talk about some of the conditions, dynamics, and contradictions that imprisoned organizers and their co-strugglers have to navigate in their work. We will be hearing from Brooke Terpstra with Oakland Abolition and Solidarity, an organization that supports imprisoned people's efforts to organize for their own self-defense against inhumane treatment. Whether you are an abolitionist or not, we should all feel compelled to highlight what's happening in jails and prisons in this country right now. The prison industrial complex is a social disposal system, and during times of crisis, such systems become even more brutal, deadly, and exploitative. That has been the case for incarcerated people during the pandemic, who have endured conditions like continuous lockdown, which means mass solitary confinement, and rampant COVID infection, without the ability to practice social distancing or access to functional health care. They also face water shortages, inedible food, and more horrors than I can enumerate here. Meanwhile, we see local officials papering over their own failures, including the carceral violence they oversee, with fear-mongering about crime and the need to crack down on violent criminals. Mayors tell already debunked lies about bail reform driving crime, and police insist that if more people were sitting in jail, we would be safer, even though no evidence supports this conclusion. They are driving a narrative about the need for a form of disposal in which guilt is determined by arresting officers and sentences begin immediately. Focusing on law and order as the solution to many of the crises we face prevents us from asking deeper questions about why we are experiencing violence and what real safety would look like. It also dehumanizes millions of people who are ensnared by the prison industrial complex, the idea that it's for the best if they simply disappear into the system. We cannot allow the normalization of human disposability to go unchallenged, now or ever, but especially now. We must resist the ways in which prisons make people disappear from our sight and the way corporate media makes them disappear from our minds. The abandonment and disposal of human beings are intensifying so that capitalism can survive and restore some semblance of the status quo. But people behind jail and prison walls are not passively accepting their oppression. They're fighting back. To aid our understanding of that struggle, I asked Brooke Terpstra for some background on some of the resistance imprisoned people have been leading in Oakland lately. Complexities of engaging with struggles for better conditions within institutions that should not exist. In my own organizing work, incarceration-related demands tend to center on getting people out of jail, prison, or detention. But when people are trapped inside, their well-being must be defended. And with millions of people locked conditions, we are going to see mobilizations around those conditions, led by imprisoned people. We have to meet those mobilizations the way we would meet any group of marginalized people rebelling against the deadly conditions being imposed upon them. Thank you for listening to Movement Memos. This show wouldn't exist if it weren't for Truth Out, and Truth Out's independent news and commentary wouldn't exist without listeners and readers like you. We have no paywalls, no corporate sponsors, and no ads, except for fundraising appeals like this one. So if you can and would like to support our work, please consider dropping by truthout.org to make a donation today.
Here on Black Bob Road, watching cars go by with their signs saying that they want the district to take these claims of harassment seriously. But the district says they've investigated those claims and they've done what they need to do. Olathe students say they deserve better, not only them, but women in the district office.
It's not okay. I support them 100%, and I think it's very brave for them to speak out. And so many people in the school district are for them.
In February, claims from three women within the district who say they were harassed by Rich Wilson. He's the director of curriculum and assessment for the district. Last month, a lawyer for one of the women said after filing a sexual harassment claim, she was retaliated against.
Rather than make life better for her, rather than remove the conditions, they offered her a demotion, and later they offered her a severance, and in conjunction with that, they offered to pay her to keep quiet about it, essentially.
Wilson is still employed with the district. Students didn't call for him to be fired, but said the district's handling of the situation was poor.
Angry that the school district would let this keep happening.
One of the women is hoping to sue the district for not handling the situation appropriately.
When there are multiple women asserting claims against one person and the district doesn't respond, that's a real concern. It's easier for the district to just say this is untrue, but it's at a certain point it just becomes implausible.
The students say they support her.
People understand that it's a problem and that it needs to change. So it's just something that we were very passionate about, but I think it just shows that like this district has potential and it is like a good district, but there are wrongdoings that need to be corrected.
So I did reach out to the district today for an updated statement and a status of everything, but I did not hear back. But they did send me a statement back when I originally reported on this last month, and what they told me is that Olathe Public Schools takes any and all allegations of staff misconduct very seriously, and we have processes and procedures in place to investigate and address them. We remain steadfast in our commitment to the integrity of our organization and the core values of Olathe Public Schools. In February, claims from three women within the district who say they were harassed by Rich Wilson.
Comment vont nos chers papayers? On me dit qu'ils ont été sauvés grâce à vos vaccins.
C'est exact.
Et votre ami Rochefort, comment se porte-t-il?
Bien, j'imagine. La liberté a ses avantages.
Pourquoi ne vous a-t-il pas emmené avec lui?
Sans doute parce que je ne sais pas nager.
Madame Lemel et vous êtes des amis du marquis. Oui. Nous savons tous les deux que Rochefort n'a pas d'amis, il n'a que des admirateurs. MacMahon est furieux. L'affaire a fait le tour de la capitale. Rochefort nous a ridiculisés, lui et ses amis francs-maçons.
Ces francs-maçons, comme vous dites, sont montés au combat avec leurs bannières. Dans les derniers jours de la commune, ils sont des nôtres.
Soit. Soit. Mais il est plus que probable que vous et vos camarades, francs-maçons ou pas, soyez les premiers à subir les conséquences de cette évasion. Moi aussi, d'ailleurs. Je risque fort d'y laisser quelques plumes. De toute façon, ma femme ne supporte pas le climat.
Je peux ?
dites ce que vous savez, et j'obtiens votre grâce.
Jamais je n'accepterai de grâce tant que mes compagnons seront retenus ici. C'est m'insulter que de me faire une telle proposition. Ce sera l'amnistie pour tous ou bien pour personne.
Cette évasion est peut-être une bonne chose. Rochefort va pouvoir témoigner pour nous. Pourquoi pas affréter un navire pour nous faire sortir d'ici?
Vous rêvez. En s'évadant, lui et ses amis ont déserté la cause à laquelle ils prétendaient appartenir. Un point, c'est tout. Leur devoir était de rester avec nous. Ils n'ont songé qu'à leur intérêt personnel.